Disc 5.
The Christmas season gave Hillary and me the chance to see Chelsea perform twice, in the Nutcracker with the Washington Ballet Company, where she went for class every day after school, and in a Christmas skit at the church we had chosen, Foundry United Methodist, on 16th Street, not far from the White House. We liked Foundry's pastor, Phil Wagaman, and the fact that the church included people of various races, cultures, incomes, and political affiliations, and openly welcomed gays. The White House is special at Christmas time. Every year, a large Christmas tree is brought in for the Oval Blue Room on the main floor. It is decorated, as are all the public rooms, according to the year's theme. Hillary made American Crafts the theme for our first Christmas. Artisans from around the country gave us Christmas ornaments and other works in glass, wood, and metal. Every Christmas, the state dining room has a huge gingerbread White House, which kids especially enjoy seeing. In 1993, about 150,000 people came through the White House during the holidays to see the decorations. We also got another big tree for the yellow oval room on the residence floor and filled it with ornaments Hillary and I had been collecting since our first Christmas together. Traditionally, Chelsea and I put on most of the ornaments, following a practice we began as soon as she was old enough. Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we hosted a large number of receptions and parties for Congress, the press, the Secret Service, the resident staff, the White House staff and cabinet, other administration officials, and supporters from around the country, family and friends. Hillary and I would stand in line for hours greeting people and taking pictures as choirs and other musical groups from around the country performed throughout the house. It was an exhausting but happy way to thank the people who made our work possible and our lives richer. Our first Christmas was especially important to me because I knew that, like our first Camp David Thanksgiving, it would almost certainly be our last one with Mother. We persuaded her and Dick to come spend a week with us, which she agreed to do when I promised I'd take her home in time for her to get ready to go to Las Vegas for Barbra Streisand's much-heralded New Year's Eve concert. Barbara really wanted her to come, and Mother was determined to go. She loved Barbara, and in her mind, Las Vegas was the closest thing she had seen to heaven on earth. I didn't know what she'd do if it turned out there was no gambling or fancy entertainment in the afterlife. While we were enjoying Christmas, Whitewater became an issue once more. For the previous several weeks, the Washington Post and the New York Times had been chasing rumors that Jim McDougal might be indicted again. In 1990, he had been tried and acquitted on charges arising out of the failure of Madison Guaranty. Apparently, the Resolution Trust Corporation was looking into whether McDougal had made illegal campaign contributions to politicians, including me. During the campaign, we had commissioned a report that proved we had lost money on the Whitewater investment. My campaign contributions were a matter of public record, and neither Hillary nor I had ever borrowed any money from Madison. I knew the whole Whitewater business was simply an attempt by my enemies to discredit me and impair my ability to serve. Nonetheless, Hillary and I decided we should hire a lawyer. David Kendall had been at Yale Law School with us. He had represented clients in savings and loan cases and understood how to organize and synthesize complex and apparently unconnected material. There was a brilliant mind behind David's modest Quaker demeanor and a willingness to fight against injustice. He had been jailed for his civil rights activity in Mississippi during Freedom Summer in 1964 and had argued death penalty cases for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Best of all, David Kendall was a terrific human being who would see us through the darkest moments of the years ahead with strength, judgment, and a great sense of humor. On December 18th, Kendall told us that the American Spectator, a right-wing monthly magazine, was about to publish an article by David Brock in which four Arkansas state troopers claimed that they had procured women for me when I was governor. Only two of the troopers agreed to be interviewed on CNN. There were some allegations in the story that could be easily disproved, and the two troopers had credibility problems of their own, unrelated to their allegations against me. They had been investigated for insurance fraud involving a state vehicle they wrecked in 1990. David Brock later apologized to Hillary and me for the story. If you want to know more, read his brave memoir, Blinded by the Right, in which he reveals the extraordinary efforts made to discredit me by wealthy right-wingers with ties to Newt Gingrich and some adversaries of mine in Arkansas. Brock acknowledges that he allowed himself to be used in the smear by people who didn't care whether the damaging information they paid for was true or not. The trooper story was ridiculous, but it hurt. It hit Hillary hard because she thought we had left all that behind in the campaign. Now she knew it might never end. For the moment, there was nothing to do but carry on and hope the story would blow over. While it was raging, we went to the Kennedy Center one night for a performance of Handel's Messiah. When Hillary and I appeared in the president's box on the balcony, the large audience stood and cheered. We were moved by the kind and spontaneous gesture. I didn't realize how upset I had been until I felt tears of gratitude fill my eyes. After a memorable Christmas week, Hillary, Chelsea, and I flew Mother and Dick home to Arkansas. Hillary and Chelsea stayed with Dorothy in Little Rock, and I drove with Mother and Dick to Hot Springs. We all went to dinner with some of my friends from high school at Rocky's Pizza, one of Mother's favorite haunts, just across the street from the racetrack. After dinner, Mother and Dick wanted to go to bed, so I took them home, then went bowling with my friends, after which we came back to the little house on Lake Hamilton to play cards and talk until the early hours of the morning. The next day, Mother and I sat alone together over a cup of coffee for what turned out to be our last visit. She was upbeat as always, saying the only reason the trooper story came out when it did was that my poll ratings had rebounded in the last month to their highest level since my inauguration. Then she chuckled and said she knew the two troopers weren't the brightest lights on the horizon, but she sure wished the boys would find some other way to make a living. For a brief moment, I got her to think about the sand running out of the hourglass. She was working on her memoirs with a fine collaborator from Arkansas, James Morgan, and she had put her entire story on tape, but there were still several chapters in the drafting stage. I asked her what she wanted to happen if she didn't finish them. She smiled and said, "You're going to finish them, of course." I said, "What are my instructions?" She said I should check the facts, change anything that was wrong, and clarify anything that was confusing. "But I want this to be my story in my words, so don't change it unless you think I've been too hard on someone who's still alive." With that, she went back to discussing politics and her trip to Las Vegas. Later that day, I kissed Mother goodbye, drove to Little Rock to pick up Hillary and Chelsea, and flew to Fayetteville to see the number one ranked Arkansas Razorbacks play basketball, then on to the Renaissance weekend with our friends Jim and Diane Blair. After a jam-packed year so full of highs and lows, it was good to have a few days with old friends. I walked on the beach, played touch football with the kids and golfed with my friends, went to the panels, and enjoyed the company. But my thoughts were never far from Mother. She was a marvel, still beautiful at 70, even after a mastectomy, chemotherapy treatments that took all her hair and forced her to wear a wig, and daily blood transfusions that would have put most people in bed. She was ending her life as she had lived it, going all out, grateful for her blessings, without a shred of self-pity for her pain and illness, and eager for the adventures of every new day she could get. She was relieved that Roger's life was on track and convinced that I was mastering my job. She would have loved to live to be 100, but if her time was up, so be it. She had found her peace with God. He could call her home, but he would have to catch her on the run. Chapter 37. The year 1994 was one of the hardest of my life, one in which important successes in foreign and domestic policy were overshadowed by the demise of health care reform and an obsession with bogus scandal. It began with personal heartbreak and ended in political disaster. On the night of January 5th, Mother called me at the White House. She had just returned home from her trip to Las Vegas. I told her I had been calling her hotel room for several days and never found her in. She laughed and said she had been out day and night, having the time of her life in her favorite city, and she didn't have time to sit around waiting for the phone to ring. She had loved Barbra Streisand's concert and was especially pleased that Barbara had introduced her and dedicated a song to her. Mother was in high spirits and seemed strong. She just wanted to check in and tell me she loved me. It wasn't much different from the countless calls we'd shared over the years, usually on Sunday nights. About 2 a.m., the phone rang again, waking Hillary and me. Dick Kelly was on the line, crying. He said, "She's gone, Bill." After a perfect but exhausting week, Mother had just gone to sleep and died. I knew it was coming, but I wasn't ready to let her go. Now our last phone conversation seemed too routine, too full of idle chit-chat. We had talked like people who think they have forever to talk to each other. I was aching to redo it, but all I could do was tell Dick that I loved him, that I was so grateful to him for making her last years happy, and that I'd get home as quickly as I could. Hillary knew what had happened from my end of the conversation. I hugged her and wept. She said something about Mother and her love of life, and I realized the phone conversation was just the kind Mother would have chosen to be our last one. My mother was always about life, not death. I called my brother, who I knew would be devastated. He worshipped Mother, and all the more because she never gave up on him. I told him he had to hold up for her and keep building his life. Then I called my friend Patty Hal Kreiner, who had been part of our lives for more than 40 years, and asked her to help Dick and me with the funeral arrangements. Hillary woke Chelsea and told her. She had already lost a grandfather, and she and Mother, whom she called Ginger, had a close, tender relationship. On the wall of her study room, she had a terrific pen and ink portrait of Mother by Hot Springs artist Gary Simmons, entitled Chelsea's Ginger. It was moving to watch my daughter coming to terms with the loss of someone else she loved, trying to express her grief and keep her composure, letting go and holding on. Chelsea's Ginger is hanging in her room in Chappaqua today. Later that morning, we put out a release announcing Mother's death, which was all over the news immediately. By coincidence, Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich were on the morning news programs. Undeterred by the moment, interviewers asked about Whitewater. To one, Dole replied that it cries out for the appointment of an independent counsel. I was stunned. I would have thought that even the press and my adversaries would take a time out on the day of my mother's death. To his credit, a few years later, Dole apologized to me. By then, I better understood what had happened. Washington's narcotic of choice is power. It dulls the senses and clouds the judgment. Dole was not even close to being its worst abuser. I was touched by his apology. That same day, Al Gore went to Milwaukee to deliver a foreign policy speech I had agreed to make, and I flew home. Dick and Mother's house was full of their friends, family, and the food Arkansas folks bring to ease common grieving. We all laughed and told stories about her. The next day, Hillary and Chelsea arrived, as did some of Mother's other friends from out of state, including Barbra Streisand and Ralph Wilson, the owner of the Buffalo Bills, who had invited Mother to the Super Bowl the previous year when he learned she was a huge Bills fan. No church was big enough to hold all Mother's friends, and it was too cold to hold the funeral service at her preferred venue, the racetrack, so we scheduled it for the convention center. About 3,000 people came, including Senator Pryor, Governor Tucker, and all my college roommates. But most of the attendees were simple working people whom Mother had met and befriended over the years. All the women from her birthday club were there, too. There were 12 members, each with a birthday in a different month. They celebrated them together over monthly lunches. After Mother died, as she requested, the other women picked a replacement, and they renamed their group the Virginia Clinton Kelly Birthday Club. The Reverend John Miles presided over the service, referring to Mother as an American original. Virginia, he said, was like a rubber ball. The harder life put her down, the higher she bounced. Brother John reminded the crowd of Mother's automatic response to every problem. That's no hill for a stepper. The service featured the hymn she loved. We all sang Amazing Grace and Precious Lord, Take My Hand. Her friend Malvy Lee Giles, who once lost her voice completely, then got it back from God with an extra octave to spare, sang His Eye Is on the Sparrow, and Mother's favorite, A Closer Walk with Thee. Our Pentecostal friend, Janice Jostrand, sang a powerful hymn Mother had heard at my inaugural church service, Holy Ground. When Barbara Streisand, who was sitting behind me, heard Janice, she touched my shoulder and shook her head in amazement. When the service was over, she asked, "Who is that woman and what is that music? It's magnificent." Barbara was so inspired by Mother's funeral music that she made her own album of hymns and inspirational songs, including one written in Mother's memory, Leading with Your Heart. After the funeral, we drove Mother home to Hope. All along the way, people were standing by the road to show their respect. She was buried in the cemetery across the street from where her father's store had been, in the plot that had long awaited her, beside her parents and my father. It was January 8th, the birthday of her favorite man outside the family, Elvis Presley. After a reception at the Sizzlin Steakhouse, we drove to the airport to fly back to Washington. There was no time to grieve. I had to go back to putting things together. As soon as I dropped Hillary and Chelsea off, I left for a long-planned trip to Europe to establish a process for opening NATO's door to the Central European nations in a way that wouldn't cause Yeltsin too many problems in Russia. I was determined to do everything I could to create a Europe that was united, free, democratic, and secure for the first time in history. I had to make sure NATO expansion didn't simply lead to a new division of Europe farther to the east. In Brussels, after a speech in the City Hall to a group of young Europeans, I received a special gift. Belgium was celebrating the 100th anniversary of the death of my favorite Belgian, Adolphe Sax, inventor of the saxophone, and the mayor of Dinant, Sax's hometown, presented me with a beautiful new Selmer tenor sax made in Paris. The next day, the NATO leaders approved my Partnership for Peace proposal to increase our security cooperation with Europe's new democracies until we could achieve the expansion of NATO itself. On January 11th, I was in Prague with Václav Havel, 24 years to the week after my first trip there as a student. Havel, a small, soft-spoken man with dancing eyes and a biting wit, was a hero to the forces of freedom everywhere. He had been in prison for years and used the time to write eloquent and provocative books. When he was released, he led Czechoslovakia through a peaceful velvet revolution, then oversaw the orderly division of the country into two states. Now he was the president of the Czech Republic, eager to build a successful market economy and to claim the security of NATO membership. Havel was a good friend of our UN ambassador, Madeleine Albright, who was born in Czechoslovakia and delighted in every opportunity she had to speak with him in their native tongue. Havel took me to one of the jazz clubs that had been hotbeds of support for his Velvet Revolution. After the group played a couple of tunes, he brought me up to meet the band and presented me with another new saxophone, this one made in Prague by a company that, in communist times, had produced saxophones for the military bands throughout the Warsaw Pact nations. He invited me to play it with the band. We did Summertime and My Funny Valentine, with Havel enthusiastically joining in on the tambourine. On the way to Moscow, I stopped briefly in Kiev to meet with Ukraine's president, Leonid Kravchuk, to thank him for the agreement that he, Yeltsin, and I would sign the following Friday, committing Ukraine to eliminate 176 intercontinental ballistic missiles and 1,500 nuclear warheads targeted at the United States. Ukraine was a large country of 60 million people with great potential. Like Russia, it was wrestling with the question of exactly what kind of future it wanted. Kravchuk faced considerable opposition in Parliament to getting rid of his nuclear weapons, and I wanted to support him. Hillary met me in Moscow. She brought Chelsea, too, because we didn't want her to be alone right after Mother's death. Staying together in the guest quarters of the Kremlin and seeing Moscow in the dead of winter would be a good distraction for all of us. Yeltsin knew I was hurting because he also had recently lost his mother, whom he adored. Whenever we had a chance, we took to the streets, shopping for Russian artifacts and buying bread at a small bakery. I lit a candle for Mother at the Kazan Cathedral, now fully restored from the ravages of Stalinism, and visited the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church in the hospital. On January 14th, after an impressive welcoming ceremony in the Kremlin St. George's Hall, a massive white room with high arches and columns, with the names of more than 200 years of Russia's war heroes emblazoned in gold, Yeltsin and I signed the nuclear agreement with Ukrainian President Kravchuk and held talks about economic and security initiatives. In the press conference afterward, Yeltsin expressed his appreciation for the American aid package and the one approved at the Tokyo G7 meeting, for the commitment of $1 billion more in each of the next 2 years, and for our decision to reduce tariffs on 5,000 Russian products. He gave a qualified endorsement of the Partnership for Peace on the strength of my commitment to work out a special cooperative agreement between NATO and Russia. I was also pleased that we had agreed as of May 30th not to target our nuclear missiles against each other or any other country, and that the United States would buy $12 billion worth of highly enriched uranium from Russia over the next 20 years, gradually removing it from any possibility of being used to make weapons. I thought all these actions were good for both the United States and Russia, but not everyone agreed. Yeltsin was having some problems with his new parliament, especially with Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the leader of a sizable bloc of militant nationalists who wanted to return Russia to imperial glory and were convinced I was trying to reduce its power and reach. To push back a bit, I repeated my mantra that the Russian people should define their greatness in terms relevant to the future, not the past. After the press conference, I did a town hall meeting with young people at the Austin Kino television station. They asked questions about all the current issues, but they also wanted to know whether American students could learn anything from Russia, how old I was when I first thought of becoming president, what advice I could give a young Russian who wanted to go into politics, and how I wanted to be remembered. The students made me hopeful about the future of Russia. They were intelligent, idealistic, and fiercely committed to democracy. The trip was going well, advancing important American interests in building a safer, freer world, but you would never have known it back home, where the only thing the politicians and press wanted to talk about was Whitewater. I even got questions about it on my trip from the American press accompanying me. Even before I left, the Washington Post and the New York Times had joined the Republicans in demanding that Janet Reno appoint an independent counsel. The only new development in recent months was that David Hale, a Republican who had been indicted in 1993 for defrauding the Small Business Administration, had said I had asked him to make a loan to Susan McDougal, for which she was ineligible. I had not done so. The standard for appointing an independent counsel under both the old law, which had expired, and the new one being considered by Congress was credible evidence of wrongdoing. In its January 5th editorial calling for an independent counsel in Whitewater, the Washington Post explicitly acknowledged that there had been no credible charge in this case that either the president or Mrs. Clinton did anything wrong. Nevertheless, the Post said the public interest demanded an independent counsel, because Hillary and I had been partners in the Whitewater real estate deal, on which we lost money, before McDougal bought Madison Guaranty, from which we never borrowed money. Even worse, we had apparently failed to take the full tax deduction for our losses. It was probably the first time in history when the flames of outrage against a politician were fanned because of money he lost, loans he didn't receive, and a tax deduction he didn't take. The Post said the Justice Department was headed by presidential appointees who couldn't be trusted to investigate me or to decide whether someone else should investigate me. The independent counsel law was enacted in reaction to President Nixon's firing of Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox, who had been appointed by Nixon's attorney general and therefore was an executive branch employee subject to termination. Congress recognized both the need for independent investigations of alleged wrongdoing by the president and his major appointees, and the danger of giving unlimited power to an unaccountable prosecutor with limitless resources. That's why the law required credible evidence of wrongdoing. Now the press was saying the president should agree to an independent counsel without such evidence whenever anyone with whom he had ever been associated was being investigated. In the Reagan-Bush years, more than 20 people were convicted of felonies by independent counsels. After 6 years of investigations and a finding by Senator John Towers' commission that President Reagan had authorized the illegal sales of arms to the Nicaraguan rebels, Iran-Contra prosecutor Lawrence Walsh indicted Caspar Weinberger and five others, but President Bush pardoned them. The only independent counsel investigation into a president's activities before he took office involved President Carter, who was investigated for a disputed loan to a peanut warehouse he and his brother Billy owned. The special prosecutor the president requested finished his investigation in 6 months, exonerating the Carters. By the time I got to Moscow, several Democratic senators and President Carter had joined the Republicans and the press in calling for an independent counsel, though they couldn't give a reason that approached credible evidence of wrongdoing. Most of the Democrats didn't know a thing about Whitewater. They were just anxious to show they didn't object to Democratic presidents being investigated, and they didn't want to be on the other side of the Washington Post and the New York Times. They also probably thought that Janet Reno could be trusted to appoint a professional prosecutor who would deal with the problem promptly. Regardless, it was clear we had to do something, in Lloyd Benson's words, to lance the boil. When I arrived in Moscow, I got on a conference call with my staff, David Kendall, and Hillary, who was still in Washington, to discuss what we should do. David Gergen, Bernie Nussbaum, and Kendall were against asking for an independent counsel because there were no grounds for one, and if we got unlucky, an unscrupulous prosecutor could pursue an endless disruptive investigation. Moreover, it wouldn't have to last long to bankrupt us. I had the lowest net worth of any president in modern history. Nussbaum, a world-class lawyer who had worked with Hillary on the congressional Watergate inquiry, was adamantly against a special prosecutor. He called it an evil institution because it gave unaccountable prosecutors the ability to do anything they wanted. Bernie said I owed it to the presidency and to myself to resist a special prosecutor with everything I had. Nussbaum also pointed out that the Washington Post's disdain for the Justice Department's inquiry was unfounded, since my records were being reviewed by a career prosecutor who had been nominated for a Justice Department position by President Bush. Gergen agreed, but argued forcefully that I should turn over all our records to the Washington Post. So did Mark Guerin and George Stephanopoulos. David said Len Downey, the Post's executive editor, had achieved his spurs with Watergate and had convinced himself we were covering something up. The New York Times seemed to think so, too. Gergen thought the only way to defuse the pressure for an independent counsel was to produce the documents. All the lawyers, Nussbaum, Kendall, and Bruce Lindsay, were against releasing the records, because while we had agreed to give the Justice Department everything we'd found, the records were incomplete and scattered, and we were still in the process of rounding them up. They said as soon as we couldn't answer a question or produce a document, the press would return to the drumbeat for an independent counsel. In the meantime, we'd get lots of bad stories full of innuendo and speculation. The rest of my staff, including George Stephanopoulos and Harold Ickes, who had come to work as deputy chief of staff in January, thought that because the Democrats were taking the path of least resistance, the special prosecutor was inevitable, and we should just go on and ask for it so we could get back to the people's business. I asked Hillary what she thought. She said that asking for the prosecutor would set a terrible precedent, basically changing the standard from requiring credible evidence of wrongdoing to giving in whenever a media frenzy could be stirred up. But that it had to be my decision. I could tell she was tired of fighting my staff. I told everyone on the call that I wasn't worried about an investigation because I hadn't done anything wrong and neither had Hillary, nor did I have any objections to releasing the records. After all, we had endured a lot of irresponsible Whitewater stories since the campaign. My instincts were to release the records and fight the prosecutor, but if the consensus was to do the reverse, I could live with it. Nussbaum was distraught, predicting that whoever was appointed would be frustrated when nothing was there and would keep widening the investigation until he found something someone I knew had done wrong. He said if I felt I had to do more, we should just dump the records on the press and even offer to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Stephanopoulos thought that was a terrible idea because of all the publicity it would generate. He said Reno would appoint an independent counsel who would satisfy the press and the whole thing would be over in a few months. Bernie disagreed, saying that if Congress passed a new independent counsel law and I signed it, which I had promised to do, the judges on the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals would appoint a new prosecutor and start all over again. George got angry, saying Bernie was paranoid and it would never happen. Bernie knew that Chief Justice Rehnquist would name the panel and it would be dominated by conservative Republicans. He laughed nervously at George's outburst and said maybe the chances of a second prosecutor were only 50-50. After further discussion, I asked to speak with just Hillary and David Kendall. I told them I thought we had to go along with the consensus of the non-legal staff for a special prosecutor. After all, I had nothing to hide, and all the clamor was diverting the attention of Congress and the country from our larger agenda. The next day, the White House asked Janet Reno to appoint a special prosecutor. Though I said I could live with it, I almost didn't live through it. It was the worst presidential decision I ever made. Wrong on the facts, wrong on the law, wrong on the politics, wrong for the presidency and the Constitution. Perhaps I did it because I was completely exhausted and grieving over Mother. It took all the concentration I could muster just to do the job I had left her funeral to do. What I should have done is release the records, resist the prosecutor, give an extensive briefing to all the Democrats who wanted it, and ask for their support. Of course, it might not have made any difference. At the time, I wasn't that worried about it because I knew I hadn't broken any laws, and I still believed that the press wanted the truth. Within a week, Janet Reno appointed Robert Fisk, a Republican former prosecutor from New York, who would have completed his investigation in a timely way had he been left to do his job. Of course, Fisk was not allowed to finish, but I'm getting ahead of myself. For now, agreeing to the special prosecutor was like taking aspirin for a cold. It brought temporary relief. Very temporary. On the way home from Russia, after a brief stop in Belarus, I flew to Geneva for my first meeting with President Assad of Syria. He was a ruthless but brilliant man who had once wiped out a whole village as a lesson to his opponents, and whose support of terrorist groups in the Middle East had isolated Syria from the United States. Assad rarely left Syria, and when he did, it was almost always to come to Geneva to meet with foreign leaders. On our visit, I was impressed by his intelligence and his almost total recall of detailed events going back more than 20 years. Assad was famous for long meetings. He could go on for 6 or 7 hours without taking a break. I, on the other hand, was tired and needed to drink coffee, tea, or water to stay awake. Fortunately, the meeting ran only a few hours. Our discussion produced the two things I wanted: Assad's first explicit statement that he was willing to make peace and establish normal relations with Israel, and his commitment to withdraw all Syrian forces from Lebanon and respect its independence once a comprehensive Middle East peace was reached. I knew the success of the meeting resulted from more than personal chemistry. Assad had received a lot of economic support from the former Soviet Union. That was gone now, so he needed to reach out to the West. To do that, he had to stop supporting terrorism in the region, which would be easy to do if he made an agreement with Israel that succeeded in giving back to Syria the Golan Heights lost in the 1967 war. I returned to Washington to a whole series of those all-too-typical days when everything happens at once. On the 17th, Los Angeles was struck with the most costly earthquake in U.S. history, which caused billions of dollars of damage to homes, hospitals, schools, and businesses. I flew out on the 19th with James Lee Witt, director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to view the damage, including a large stretch of interstate highway that had completely split open. On the 20th, virtually the entire cabinet and I met with Mayor Dick Reardon and other state and local leaders in an airplane hangar in Burbank to plan emergency efforts. Thanks to a remarkable partnership, the recovery occurred quickly. The main freeway was rebuilt in 3 months. FEMA gave financial help to more than 600,000 families and businesses, and thousands of homes and businesses were rebuilt with Small Business Administration loans. The entire effort involved more than $16 billion in direct aid. I was distressed for Californians. They had borne the brunt of the recession and the defense downsizing, suffered severe fires, and now the earthquake. One of the local officials joked to me that he was just waiting for a plague of locusts. His sense of humor reminded me of Mother Teresa's famous observation that she knew God would never give her a heavier burden than she could carry, but sometimes she wished he didn't have so much confidence in her. I returned to Washington to do an interview with Larry King on the first anniversary of the start of my presidency, telling him that I liked my job even on the bad days. After all, I hadn't signed up to have a good time, but to change the country. A few days later, President Assad's eldest son, whom he had groomed to succeed him, was killed in a car accident. When I called to express my condolences, Assad was obviously heartbroken, a reminder that the worst thing that can happen in life is losing a child. That week, I named the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, to succeed Les Aspin, who had resigned as secretary not long after the day of Black Hawk Down. We had conducted an exhaustive search, and all the while the best candidate had been right under our noses. Perry had led several defense-related organizations, been a professor of mathematics and engineering, and done a superb job at the Pentagon, promoting stealth technology, procurement reform, and realistic budgeting. He was a soft-spoken, modest man whose demeanor disguises surprising toughness. He would turn out to be one of my best appointments, probably the finest Secretary of Defense since General George Marshall. On the 25th, I gave my State of the Union address. It's the only time in a year when a president gets the chance to speak to the American people, unfiltered, for a whole hour, and I wanted to make the most of it. After a tribute to the late House Speaker Tip O'Neill, who had died the day before Mother, I summarized the long list of congressional achievements in 1993, saying that the economy was producing jobs, that millions of Americans had saved money by refinancing their homes at lower rates, that only 1.2% of the American people had had their income taxes increased, that the deficit would be 40% lower than previously predicted, and that we would reduce the federal payrolls by more than 250,000 instead of the 100,000 I had previously promised. The rest of the speech, was an outline of my 1994 agenda, beginning with education. I asked Congress to pass my Goals 2000 initiative to help public schools reach the national education goals the governors and the Bush administration had given the country through reforms like school choice, charter schools, and connecting all our schools to the Internet by 2000, and to measure schools' progress toward reaching the goals the old-fashioned way, by whether our students were learning what they needed to know. I also asked for more investments in new job-creating technologies and defense conversion projects, urged passage of the crime bill and a ban on assault weapons, and promoted three environmental laws, a Safe Drinking Water Act, a Revitalized Clean Water Act, and a reformed Superfund program. The Superfund was a public-private partnership to clean up polluted sites that had been abandoned and had become ugly, unusable health hazards. It was important to me and to Al Gore, and by the time we left office, we had cleaned up three times as many Superfund sites as the Reagan and Bush administrations combined. I then asked Congress to pass both welfare reform and health care reform in 1994. 1 million people were on the welfare rolls because it was the only way they could get health care for their children. When people left welfare for low-wage jobs without benefits, they were in the incredible position of paying taxes to support the Medicaid program, which provided health care for families that had stayed on welfare. At some time during each year, nearly 60 million Americans found themselves without health insurance. More than 80 million Americans had pre-existing conditions, health problems that meant they were paying more for insurance if they could get it, and often couldn't change jobs without losing it. 3 out of 4 Americans had policies with lifetime limits on how much of their health care costs would be covered, meaning they could lose their insurance just when they needed it most. The system hurt small businesses, too. Their premiums were 35% higher than those paid by large businesses and government. To control costs, more and more Americans were being forced into health maintenance organizations, which restricted patients in their choice of a doctor and doctors in their choice of care, and forced healthcare professionals to spend more and more time on paperwork and less on their patients. All these problems were rooted in one fundamental fact. We had a crazy quilt pattern of coverage in which insurance companies called the shots. I told the Congress I knew it was hard to change the system. Roosevelt, Truman, Nixon, and Carter had all tried and failed. The effort virtually destroyed Truman's presidency, driving his approval ratings below 30% and helping the Republicans gain control of the Congress. This happened because, for all our problems, most Americans had some kind of coverage, liked their doctors and hospitals, and knew we had a good system of health care delivery. All those things were still true. Those who profited from the way health care was financed were spending huge sums to convince the Congress and the people that fixing what was wrong with the health care system would destroy what it did right. I thought my argument was effective, except for one thing. At the end of the healthcare portion of the speech, I held up a pen and said I would use it to veto any bill that didn't guarantee health insurance to all Americans. I did it because a couple of my advisors had said that people wouldn't think I had the strength of my convictions unless I demonstrated that I wouldn't compromise. It was an unnecessary red flag to my opponents in Congress. Politics is about compromise, and people expect presidents to win, not posture for them. Healthcare reform was the hardest of all hills to climb. I couldn't do it alone without compromise. As it turned out, my error didn't matter, because Bob Dole would decide to kill any healthcare reform. In the short run, the State of the Union speech dramatically increased public support for my agenda. Newt Gingrich later said to me that after hearing the speech, he told the House Republicans that if I could persuade the Congressional Democrats to deliver on my proposals, our party would be in the majority for a long time. Newt sure didn't want that. So like Bob Dole, he would try to keep as much from happening before the midterm elections as possible. In the last week of January, we had a heated debate with our foreign policy team over whether to grant a visa to Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army. America had great significance to both sides in the Irish conflict. For years, ardent American supporters of the IRA had provided funds for its violent activities. Sinn Féin had a larger number of partisans here among Irish Catholics who disowned terrorism but wanted to see an end to discrimination against their co-religionists and more political autonomy with Catholic participation in Northern Ireland. The British and the Irish Protestants had their supporters too, who deplored any dealings with Sinn Féin because of its ties to the IRA, and who believed that we had no business meddling in the affairs of the United Kingdom, our strongest ally. That argument had carried the day with all my predecessors, including those sympathetic to the legitimate grievances of Northern Ireland's Catholics. Now, with the Declaration of Principles, we had to revisit it. In the Declaration, for the first time ever, the UK pledged that the status of Northern Ireland would be determined by the wishes of its citizens, and Ireland renounced its historic claim to the six counties in the north until a majority of its people voted to change its status. The more moderate Unionist and Irish Nationalist parties were cautiously supportive of the agreement. The Reverend Ian Paisley, leader of the extreme Democratic Unionist Party, was outraged by it. Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin said they were disappointed because the principles lacked specificity as to how the peace process would operate and how Sinn Féin would be able to participate in it. Notwithstanding the ambiguous responses, the British and Irish governments clearly had created pressure on all the parties to work with them for peace. From the time the declaration was issued, Adams's allies in America had been asking me to grant him a visa to visit the United States. They said it would increase his standing and his ability to get involved in the process and to press the IRA toward giving up violence. John Hume, leader of the moderate Social Democratic and Labor Party, who had built a career on nonviolent action, said he had changed his position on giving Adams a visa. He now thought it would advance the peace process. A number of Irish-American activists agreed, including my friend Bruce Morrison, who had organized our outreach to the Irish-American community in 1992, and our ambassador to Ireland, Jean Kennedy Smith. There was support in Congress from her brother, Senator Ted Kennedy, Senators Chris Dodd, Pat Moynihan, and John Kerry, and New York Congressman Peter King and Tom Manton. House Speaker Tom Foley, who had long been active in Irish issues, remained strongly opposed to the visa. In early January, Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds informed us that, like John Hume, he now favored granting the visa because Adams was working for peace, and he felt the visa would give him leverage to move the IRA away from violence and into the peace process. The British government remained vehemently opposed to the visa because of the long history of IRA terror and because Adams had neither renounced violence nor embraced the Declaration of Principles as the basis for settling the problem. I told Albert Reynolds I would consider a visa if Adams had a formal invitation to speak in the United States. Shortly afterward, Adams, along with the leaders of Northern Ireland's other parties, was invited to participate in a peace conference in New York hosted by an American foreign policy group. This put the visa question front and center, where it became the first important issue on which my foreign policy advisors couldn't reach a consensus. Warren Christopher and the State Department, including our ambassador to Great Britain, Ray Seitz, were strongly opposed to issuing the visa, arguing that since Adams wouldn't renounce violence, it would make us look soft on terrorism and that it could do irreparable damage to our vaunted special relationship with Great Britain, including our ability to secure British cooperation on Bosnia and other important matters. The Justice Department, the FBI, and the CIA agreed with State. Their unanimous opinion was entitled to great weight. Three people were working the Irish issue at the National Security Council: Tony Lake, NSC Staff Director Nancy Soderberg, and our European Affairs person, Army Major Jane Hall. With my support, they were taking an independent look at the visa question while trying to reach a consensus position with the State Department, working through Undersecretary Peter Tarnoff. The NSC team became convinced that Adams favored an end to IRA violence, full participation by Sinn Féin in the peace process, and a democratic future for Northern Ireland. Their analysis made sense. The Irish were beginning to prosper economically. Europe as a whole was moving toward greater economic and political integration, and tolerance for terrorism among the Irish had dropped. On the other hand, the IRA was a tough nut to crack, full of hard men who had built a life on hatred of the British and the Ulster Unionists, and for whom the idea of peaceful coexistence and continuing to be a part of the UK was anathema. Since the population of the northern counties was about 10% more Protestant than Catholic, and the Declaration of Principles committed both Ireland and the UK to a democratic future based on majority rule, Northern Ireland was likely to remain a part of the UK for some time to come. Adams understood that, but he also knew that terror wouldn't bring victory, and he seemed genuine when he said he wanted the IRA to give it up in return for an end to discrimination against and isolation of Catholics. Based on this analysis, the NSC determined that we should grant the visa because it would boost Adams' leverage within Sinn Féin and the IRA while increasing American influence with him. That was important because unless the IRA renounced violence and Sinn Féin became a part of the peace process, the Irish problem could not be resolved. The debate raged on until a few days before the conference was scheduled to open, with both the British government and Adams's allies in the Congress and the Irish-American community turning up the heat. I listened carefully to both sides, including an impassioned last-minute plea not to do it from Warren Christopher, and a message from Adams saying the Irish people were taking risks for peace, and I should take a risk too. Nancy Soderbergh said she had come around on the visa because she was convinced that Adams was serious about making peace, and that at present he couldn't say any more about his desire to move away from violence than he already had without damaging his position within Sinn Féin and the IRA. Nancy had advised me on foreign policy since the campaign, and I had developed a great respect for her judgment. I was also impressed that Tony Lake agreed with her. As my national security advisor, he had to deal with the British on many other issues that could be adversely affected by the visa. He also understood the implications of the decision in terms of our overall efforts to combat terrorism. Vice President Gore also clearly grasped the larger context in which the decision had to be made, and he favored the visa too. I decided to issue it, but to restrict it so that Adams couldn't do any fundraising or travel outside New York during his 3-day stay. The British were furious. They thought Adams was just a fast-talking deceiver who had no intention of giving up the violence that had included an attempt to assassinate Margaret Thatcher and had already claimed the lives of thousands of British citizens, including innocent children, government officials, and a member of the royal family, Lord Mountbatten, who had overseen the end of British rule in India. The Unionist parties boycotted the conference because Adams was coming. For days, John Major refused to take my phone calls. The British press was filled with articles and columns saying I had damaged the special relationship between our countries. One memorable headline read, "Slimy Snake Adams Spits Venom at Yanks." Some of the press implied that I had issued the visa to appeal to the Irish vote in America and because I was still angry at Major for his attempts to help President Bush during the campaign. It wasn't true. I had never been as upset with Major as the British believed, and I admired him for sticking his neck out with the Declaration of Principles. He had a slim majority in Parliament and needed the votes of the Irish Unionists to keep it. Moreover, I despised terrorism, as did the American people. Politically, there was a lot more downside than upside to the decision. I was granting the visa because I thought it was the best shot we had to bring the violence to an end. I remembered Yitzhak Rabin's adage, You do not make peace with your friends. Jerry Adams came to the United States on January 31st and received a warm reception from Irish Americans sympathetic to the cause. During the visit, he promised to push Sinn Féin to make concrete positive decisions. Afterward, the British accelerated their efforts to get political talks going with the Northern Irish parties, and the Irish government increased its pressure on Sinn Féin to cooperate. 7 months later, the IRA declared a ceasefire. The visa decision had worked. It was the beginning of my deep engagement in the long, emotional, complicated search for peace in Northern Ireland. On February 3rd, I began the day at my second national prayer breakfast. Mother Teresa was the guest speaker, and I argued that we should emulate her in bringing more humility and a spirit of reconciliation to politics. That afternoon, I did a little reconciliation work myself, lifting our long trade embargo on Vietnam, based on remarkable cooperation from the Vietnamese government in resolving POW and MIA cases, and in returning the remains of slain servicemen to the United States. My decision was strongly supported by Vietnam veterans in Congress, especially Senators John Kerry, Bob Kerry, and John McCain, and Congressman Pete Peterson of Florida, who had been a prisoner of war in Vietnam for more than 6 years. In the second week of February, after the brutal shelling of the Sarajevo marketplace by Bosnian Serbs had killed dozens of innocent people, NATO finally voted, with the approval of the UN Secretary General, to bomb the Serbs if they didn't move their heavy guns more than a dozen miles away from the city. It was long overdue, but still not a vote without risk for the Canadians, whose forces in Srebrenica were surrounded by the Serbs, or for the French, British, Spanish, and Dutch, who also had relatively small and vulnerable numbers of troops on the ground. Soon afterward, the heavy weapons were removed or put under UN control. Senator Dole was still pushing for a unilateral lifting of the arms embargo, but for the moment, I was willing to stick with it because we had finally gotten a green light for the NATO airstrikes, and because I didn't want others to use our unilateral abandonment of the Bosnian embargo as an excuse to disregard the embargoes we supported in Haiti, Libya, and Iraq. In the middle of the month, Hillary and Chelsea left for Lillehammer, Norway, to represent America at the Winter Olympics, and I flew down to Hot Springs for a day to see Dick Kelly. It had been 5 weeks since Mother's funeral, and I wanted to check on him. Dick was lonely in their little house where Mother's presence was still strong in every room, but the old Navy veteran was getting his sea legs back and thinking about how to get on with his life. I spent the next 2 weeks plugging health care reform and the crime bill in different venues across the country, and dealing with foreign policy. We got a piece of good news when Saudi Arabia agreed to buy $6 billion worth of American planes, after intense efforts by Ron Brown, Mickey Cantor, and Transportation Secretary Federico Pena. We also got a shock when the FBI arrested 31-year veteran CIA agent Aldrich Ames and his wife, breaking one of the biggest espionage cases in American history. For 9 years, Ames had made a fortune giving up information that had led to the deaths of more than 10 of our sources in Russia and had done severe damage to our intelligence capability. After years of trying to catch a spy they knew was there, the FBI, with CIA cooperation, finally nailed him. The Ames case called into question both the vulnerability of our intelligence apparatus and our policy toward Russia. If they were spying on us, shouldn't we cancel or suspend aid to them? In a bipartisan congressional meeting and in responses to press questions, I argued against suspending aid. Russia was engaged in an internal struggle between yesterday and tomorrow. Yesterday's Russia was spying on us, but our aid was being used to support tomorrow's Russia. By strengthening democracy and economic reform and securing and destroying its nuclear weapons. Besides, the Russians weren't the only ones with spies. Toward the end of the month, a militant Israeli settler, outraged at the prospect of turning the West Bank back to the Palestinians, gunned down several worshippers at the Mosque of Abraham in Hebron. The murderer had struck during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, at a site sacred to both Muslims and Jews, because it is thought to be the burial site of Abraham and his wife Sarah. It seemed clear that his intention was to spark a violent reaction that would derail the peace process. To head that off, I asked Warren Christopher to contact Rabin and Arafat and invite them to send negotiators to Washington as soon as possible and have them stay until they had settled on concrete actions to implement their agreement. On February 28th, NATO fighters shot down four Serb planes for violating the no-fly zone, the first military action in the 44-year history of the alliance. I hope that the airstrikes, along with our success in relieving the siege of Sarajevo, would convince the Allies to take a stronger posture toward Serb aggression in and around the embattled towns of Tuzla and Srebrenica as well. One of those Allies, John Major, was in America that day to talk about Bosnia and Northern Ireland. I took him first to Pittsburgh, where his grandfather had worked in the steel mills in the 19th century. Major seemed to enjoy retracing his roots to the industrial heartland of America. That night he stayed at the White House, the first foreign leader to do so during my tenure. The next day we held a press conference, which was unmemorable except for the larger message it sent, that our disagreement over the Adams visa would not undermine the Anglo-American relationship or keep us from working together closely on Bosnia and other issues. I found Major to be serious, intelligent, and as I said earlier, genuinely committed to resolving the Irish problem, despite the fact that the very effort to do so posed a threat to his already precarious situation in Parliament. I thought he was a better leader than his press coverage often suggested, and after our 2 days together, we maintained a friendly and productive working relationship. Chapter 38. While I was hard at work on foreign affairs, the new world of Whitewater was beginning to take shape at home. In March, Robert Fisk began his job in earnest by sending out subpoenas to several members of the White House staff, including Maggie Williams and Lisa Caputo, who worked for Hillary and were friends of Vince Foster's. Mac McClarty set up a Whitewater response team led by Harold Ickes to coordinate responses to questions from Fisk and from the press, to free the rest of the staff and me to do the public work we came to Washington to do, and to minimize conversations our staff might have about Whitewater among themselves or with Hillary or me. Any such conversations could only expose our young staffers to depositions, political attacks, and big legal bills. A lot of people had already acquired a vested interest in finding something wrong. If there was nothing illegal in our long-ago land deal, perhaps they could catch someone doing something wrong in the handling of it. The system worked well enough for me. After all, I had learned how to lead parallel lives as a child. Most of the time, I could shut out all the accusations and innuendo and go on with my work. I knew it would be harder to cope with for those who had never lived with the constant threat of arbitrary and destructive attacks, especially in an atmosphere in which there was a presumption of guilt attached to any charge. To be sure, there were some legal experts, like Sam Dash, who talked about how cooperative we were compared with the Reagan and Nixon administrations because we didn't resist subpoenas and we turned all our records over to the Justice Department and then to Fisk. But the goalposts had been moved. Unless Hillary and I could prove ourselves innocent of whatever charges any adversary could come up with, most of the questions would be asked and the stories written in a tone of intense suspicion. The underlying current was that we must have done something wrong. For example, as our financial records found their way into the press, the New York Times reported that starting with a $1,000 investment, Hillary had made $100,000 in the commodities market in 1979 with the help of Jim Blair. Blair was one of my closest friends. He did help Hillary and a number of his other friends in trading commodities, but she took her own risks, paid more than $18,000 in brokerage fees, and following her own instincts, got out of the market before it dropped. Leo Melamed, the Republican former chairman of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, on which agricultural commodities are traded, reviewed all of Hillary's trades and said there was nothing wrong with them. It didn't matter. For years, the critics would refer to Hillary's commodity profit as prima facie evidence of corruption. The presumption of wrongdoing was reflected in a Newsweek story saying Hillary did not put up her own money for her sweet deal, with an analysis that it said was based on the expert opinion of Professor Marvin Cherelstein of Columbia Law School, one of the nation's leading authorities on corporate law and contracts, who had taught me at Yale and who had been asked by our lawyer to review our tax returns for 1978-79, the period of the Whitewater investment. Cherelstein disputed the Newsweek story saying, "I never said anything like that," and that he was outraged and humiliated. About the same time, Time magazine ran a cover photograph purporting to show George Stephanopoulos peering over my shoulder as I sat at my desk fretting over Whitewater. In fact, the photo captured an earlier routine scheduling meeting at which several people were present. At least two others were in the original picture. Time simply cropped them out. In April, Hillary held a press conference to answer questions about her commodity trades and Whitewater. She did a fine job, and I was proud of her. She even got a laugh from the press corps when she acknowledged that her belief in a zone of privacy might have made her less responsive to press questions about her past personal dealings than she should have been, but that after resisting for a long time, I've been rezoned. The presumption of guilt imposed on us was extended to others. For example, Roger Altman and Bernie Nussbaum were both heavily criticized for discussing criminal referrals issued against Madison Guaranty by the Resolution Trust Corporation, because the RTC was a part of the Treasury Department and Altman was overseeing it temporarily. Presumably, the critics thought Nussbaum could have been trying to influence the RTC proceedings. In fact, the discussions were a result of the need to answer press questions arising out of leaks about the Madison investigation, and they had been approved by the Treasury Department's Ethics Council. Edwin Yoder, an old-fashioned progressive columnist, said Washington was being overtaken by ethical cleansers. In a column on the Nussbaum-Altman meeting, he said, "I wish someone would begin by explaining to me why it is so very wicked for White House staff to want information from elsewhere within the executive branch about charges and rumors concerning the president." Robert Fisk found the contacts between the White House and the Treasury Department to be legal, but that didn't stop the smearing of Nussbaum and Altman. Back then, all our political appointees needed to be read their Miranda warnings three times a day. Bernie Nussbaum resigned in early March. He never got over my foolish decision to ask for an independent counsel, and he didn't want to be a source of further problems. Altman would leave government service a few months later. They were both able, honest public servants. In March, Roger Ailes, a longtime Republican operative who had become president of CNBC, accused the administration of a cover-up with regard to Whitewater that includes land fraud, illegal contributions, abuse of power, suicide cover-up, possible murder. So much for the credible evidence of wrongdoing standard. William Safire, the New York Times columnist, who had been a speechwriter for Nixon and Agnew, and who seemed determined to prove that all their successors were just as bad as they were, was especially avid in his unsupported assertions that Vince's death was linked to illegal conduct by Hillary and me. Of course, Vince's suicide note had said exactly the reverse, that we had done nothing wrong, but that didn't prevent Safire from speculating that Vince had improperly kept records damaging to us in his office. We now know that a lot of the so-called information that fueled the damaging but erroneous stories was fed to the press by David Hale and the right-wingers who adopted him for their own purposes. In 1993, Hale, the Republican municipal judge in Little Rock, was charged with defrauding the Small Business Administration of $900,000 in federal funds that were supposed to have been used to make loans to minority businesses through his company, Capital Management Services. A later GAO audit indicated that he had defrauded the SBA of $3.4 million. Instead, he gave the money to himself through a series of dummy corporations. Hale discussed his plight with Justice Jim Johnson, the old Arkansas racist who had run against Win Rockefeller for governor in 1966 and against Senator Fulbright in 1968. Johnson took Hale under his wing and in August put him in contact with a conservative group called Citizens United, whose principals were Floyd Brown and David Bossie. Brown had produced the infamous Willie Horton ads against Mike Dukakis in 1988. Bossie had helped him write a book for the 1992 campaign entitled Slick Willie, Why America Cannot Trust Bill Clinton, in which the authors gave special thanks to Justice Jim Johnson. Hale claimed that I had pressed him to lend $300,000 from Capital Management to a company owned by Susan McDougal for the purpose of giving it out to leading Arkansas Democrats. In return, McDougal would lend Hale more than $800,000 from Madison Guaranty, enabling him to get another $1 million from the Small Business Administration. It was an absurd and untrue story, but Brown and Bossie peddled it hard. Apparently, Sheffield Nelson also helped by pushing it to his contact at the New York Times, Jeff Girth. By March 1994, the media was wringing its hands about some documents shredded by the Rose firm. One of the boxes that held the papers had Vince Foster's initials on it. The firm explained that the shredding involved material unrelated to Whitewater and was a normal procedure involving papers that were no longer needed. No one in our White House knew about the routine destruction of unneeded records unrelated to Whitewater at the Rose firm. Moreover, we had nothing to cover up, and there still wasn't a bit of evidence to indicate that we did. It got so bad that even the highly respected journalist David Broder referred to Bernie Nussbaum as unfortunate for allegedly tolerating arrogance and abuse of power that led to the all-too-familiar words investigation, subpoena, grand jury, resignation that had echoed through Washington again this past week. Broder even compared the war rooms that managed our campaigns for the economic plan and NAFTA to Nixon's enemies list. Nussbaum was unfortunate, all right. There would have been no investigation, subpoenas, or grand jury if I had listened to him and refused to give in to the demands for an independent counsel to clear the air.
End of Disc 5.